Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel. A delight to have you with us on this Thursday, the 27th of March. Joining us for our discussion this morning, WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe.
It is also a pleasure to welcome back Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld to the proceedings.
Good morning,
Ira.
Good morning.
And to our dear friend, Albany professor and investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo, who we just learned will be with us till the end of time.
I come from a very long-lived family.
Yeah, she was making a point to my Weight Watchers stuff that genetics is the number one thing. It's the trump card, and I agree with that. I agree with that. And many of us would be dead now if we just followed it.
I'm going to sit on the couch, eat ice cream, read about all those people in the obits.
But with that genetic thing, like in your family, you know, you can say, well, most of the family lived to be like 85.
Right.
But then there was that one.
Aunt Tilly.
Right. Aunt Tilly, you know, dropped dead at 50. And you're like, well, am I going to be like Aunt Tilly or am I going to be like the rest
of them?
No,
you look at the composite.
Okay.
I mean, and Pete Seeger's father lived for a long, long time. His brother died at 95. He died at 94. Those are darn good genes.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
you'll notice that I'm decidedly silent on matters of health and diet.
Why is that?
Because I feel like I like to hold my expertise to something that I can back up with, with a good shining example.
Do you want to rant about the weather again?
No. I'm going to find a movie that we can relate to today. That's my mission of the day. That reminds me of this 1938 movie, and Joe will be the only one in the room who remembers it, and he'll know who directed it, too.
Well, that's true, but, as our friend Joe Brody on our board always points out, no more than 10 minutes on health because otherwise it becomes an organ recital.
That's very funny.
That's good.
Let's begin with the news of the day, and we'll start with a lot of good stories today. Really good stuff to talk about, and interested to get. I even had an NSA story for you, Rosemary. I don't know if we'll get to it or not, but if things start to flag, we always have the NSA
I'll pull
story.
That out. Or TSA, I can do on that in any minute too. So,
well, I ate lunch with a guy yesterday, Rosemary, who was very angry at you for comparing what Richard Nixon did with the IRS with what Obama did with the IRS. Boy, was he angry! He says, it's not the same thing.
I believe I said that he was accused of doing the same thing, Richard Nixon. Actually, the charges on the IRS being steered in a certain way by Obama have been largely debunked.
Yeah.
There was some mishandling of the program, but it was certainly not.
Except if you listen to Fox News.
I
always feel it's my duty to change the channels.
Well, it isn't.
And last night, as I was changing the channels, I particularly wanted to see if my theory, which is now being argued with on another program, that CNN is overdoing the plane.
Oh, here we go.
So I'm not going to talk about it from that perspective.
You're fixated
on that,
Ira.
But I went from CNN, which talked about the plane, to Hardball, of all places, which was talking about the plane, to Fox, where they were talking about Daryl Issa and the IRS.
Yeah, sure. Well, they're nothing more than a cheap mouthpiece.
One track mind. Mm. That and Benghazi. I can't hear any more about Benghazi.
Well, if Hillary gets nominated, that's all we're going to hear
about.
You got
it.
The President of the United States spoke yesterday, and he decided on Wednesday to increase military deployments in Eastern Europe, and aides said he would intensify efforts to broaden energy security, negotiate a trade agreement with Europe, and upgrade military capabilities. As the New York Times points out this morning, yet it will be hard to back up words with resources. The United States has only a small fraction of the force it once had in Europe. Expanded energy ties will take years, and his own party leaders oppose quick action on a new trade pact. But once again, the president renewing the U.S. commitment to NATO alliance.
I'm Putin sitting in the Kremlin, and I'm looking at this saying, oh boy, more planes in Poland. I'm scared. It's ridiculous. The West and the United States has transmitted nothing except that they are not going to do anything. They're going to let Putin have Crimea. They're going to hope he doesn't go any further into Ukraine. But even if he does, I don't think they're going to do much more about that. They do not want to take the steps that would be required to really hurt him. We have to stop this empty steps would be to cut back on gas, on purchases of gas from Russia, and that's not us. That would be
it
Germany
might be us.
And France.
We might be us. We had a very good letter yesterday, a little late, saying this is all a part of the fracking thing. The president wants fracking, and we're going to sell our gas.
It's all about fracking, huh? Yeah. That's interesting. I don't know. For one thing, you know, we said we're going to tighten financial sanctions on Russia, right? Well, the first thing that Putin does is say to Ukraine, the independent Ukraine, you can't have any more breaks, any more discounts on your gas. You're going to pay full price. That's like a huge amount of money that he suddenly has now in his treasury. We have not hurt him at all.
No, I agree with that. I do. I hate to say it, but I agree with that.
Well, I'm just hard pressed to know what we ought to be doing. It seems to me that nobody has an appetite for military conflict. I mean, that just seems insane.
Well, except in history, except IRA history will teach us that when nobody has an appetite for that, you know, Chamberlain and all the rest, the bullies will do what they want.
Yeah, well, that's right, and that's what we have to be wary of. But in the meantime, I mean, I agree that the initial sanctions seem awfully soft. They've targeted a handful of his friends for sanctions. But I do think there is something symbolic about the NATO involvement. I think there's something symbolic. And by changing the G8 to the G7, I mean, Putin enjoyed being on the world stage, enjoyed being part of that larger group. It sort of legitimized him and his government. So now they've been marginalized.
Okay, but
is that enough? I don't know.
But Ira, but if let's just say he goes into Moldova, where my niece is, or to Estonia, or one of those places that are not NATO countries, the one thing that might get him to stop is the appearance of warships and warplanes saying we're going to help these countries. And that's not going to happen.
Don't believe it. Don't believe we'll put the ships there, and don't believe that would stop them, even if we did. What's really needed is something long term on the part of the United States and its allies, which is, what do we really care about? We don't care about Ukraine. We don't. That's Putin's. He cares a lot about it.
You're right.
Which is why he's going to do whatever he needs to. So what do we care? What if this were Cuba again? What if this were, where would there have to be?
Oh, any NATO country we care about. Let me tell you that right now.
So not Syria then, we did a whole lot. You cross that red line and we're coming after you.
Well, you know,
I
am so confused about Syria, to be honest with you. I'm so confused because, you know, we hate Assad. President goes on and says Assad has to go. To what end?
So that he's going to be back in. It's really looking bad.
No. Let's assume that he's won, because I think he has. But what happens to the other guys? Right. In other words, are these going to be the al-Qaeda of tomorrow? That has been our experience before. Do we ever think two steps ahead? That's why I'm confused about Syria, and will continue to be.
Well, I think, and to both of your points, when you look at any of these crises, whether it be what's going on in the Ukraine, you said, you know, we don't care about that. Okay, there's that. We have Egypt. We have Korea. Sure. We have Syria. I mean,
Venezuela is falling apart. What do we think about that?
So
I don't know.
How do you – is that a system of prioritization, or does it become a standard policy where this is what we're going to do? Because, again, this gets into what you were talking about. What do we care about?
That's right. What does everybody care about?
Right.
You know, we like to think, don't we, that the people in the State Department are smarter than we are. We like to think that they have contingency plans, that they know how bad things are in each case. I'm looking at Egypt right now. We've been all over the globe saying, let's cut out, let's just put a stop to supporting dictators, Assad's and this guy and that guy. In comes Morsi, right? All of a sudden, it looks real bad. And now, what's the guy's name, Sisi?
Sisi
comes in.
General.
He looks just as much as a dictator as anything we have ever seen. Yeah. The newspapers are being co-opted. The people are being co-opted. People are being led away. 500 people are being condemned to death who are on the other side. And guess where we are? Mama.
It's hard to know what to do. You know, under Bush, we had this clear wrong, but clear policy that we were going to act wherever American interests were involved. We weren't going to worry too much about our allies. We were going to American exceptionalism. We were the power in the world. We were going to act that way. That did not work for us. And now there's not a policy that I can see that has replaced that. Can you? What's our view of the world now?
Well, I think the view of the world now is the opposite of the Bush view, which was if something's going on, we need to get involved. And right. I think I happen to agree with it. The view is now not every fight is our fight. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be interested. We shouldn't be prepared if it has to be our fight. But I don't know that we need to jump in with both feet as soon as something happens.
Well, I actually hate that we're part of the reason we cannot act, that we're not nimble right now, is because we are still involved in Afghanistan and in Iraq, which were disasters.
To say nothing of Pakistan, where they're meeting with the, as we speak, meeting with the people we've been fighting in these other places, trying to work out a deal which we've always known existed.
What's going on, right? So we're stuck in there, and so we're less nimble in Eastern Europe.
And that says nothing to not only what all of these episodes have meant to us in terms of human lives,
right?
But look what it has done to the finances of our country, to the treasure
of
our company.
And ignored in all of this is the Pacific Rim, which I think Obama was right in identifying early. That's the future. That's where we should be. We how can you even concentrate on that right now? You
know? I would like to say, and I don't know that I'm optimistic that this is going to happen, but that if Putin becomes too aggressive within his country and makes it, tries to put it together in the manner of the old Soviet Union, that people in that country who remember the old Soviet Union and who are happy to see the Soviet Union break up will reform and help break up the Soviet Union.
But not yet, Ira. Right now, every public opinion indication we have is that people are patting them on the back.
Well,
look at the polls. They're asking who did the right thing, Obama, the West, Putin.
Right.
I mean, I'd vote for Putin under that poll. He did do exactly what he should have. He acted in the self-interest of his country. But long-term, I think Ira is right. There is no heart on the part of the Russian people to go back to a big military and to only have a big Soviet power. They want what we have.
From your mouths to heaven's ear.
Sorry.
We have 3 minutes, and I just want to read this first statement, and then I want you to comment on it. President Obama has spent much of his presidency mired in the challenges of a world well outside the borders of Europe, the turmoil of the Middle East, the power struggles in Asia, the terrorist threats percolating in northern Africa, Pakistan, and elsewhere. But Russia's invasion of Ukraine and its stunningly fast annexation of Crimea have demanded a renewed focus on the part of the world that dominated American attention in the 20th century, often accused of neglecting Europe. In his first 5 years in office, Mr. Obama is using his trip to recommit to the NATO alliance. How, and this is just sort of bringing this all together, but how much do you think the president has neglected Europe in his term in office, and is it too little too late at this point?
I think Obama clearly wanted to give Europe to the dominance of the EU when he came in. It was time for them to step up and to handle it. And, of course, they've been mired in their own financial dissolution, and that hasn't happened. And there's such disunity in the EU that and no strong action. I see that in Bosnia since I've worked there. They just have not acted to do what they're supposed to. So it still falls into the United States.
I'm not a student of American history to the extent of Alan, certainly, and probably Rosemary and Joe. I don't know whether or not history is repeating itself here, but I can't help but think that Obama's term, his 6 years now, so much of these 6 years have been mired in within our borders disputes, political disputes, his inability to get his appointees through, the amount of time that he's spent fighting with the other party to get what I would call routine business done, that it has taken away from his ability to do other things. Now, I understand when you're the president of the United States, you have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. So it's not really an excuse to say that he's had spent so much time internally that he hasn't been able to concentrate as much externally. But nevertheless, I believe that that's a factor. I think Rosemary is right. I think he wants the EU to carry on its own. And I think it's partly because he doesn't want to have to deal with it because he's got too much to deal with elsewhere.
Well, I think he's been a very good president.
I didn't mean to criticize him.
I think he's been a good president, and I think he has to react. He's playing handball. You know, somebody throws the ball against the wall, and you've got to react to it and hit it real hard back. I mean, I think this is not an easy job. There's a reason his hair is turning gray, but I think he's doing a good job.
And I think he's doing just a fine job. But Alan, I wanted a great president.
Yeah, he's been disappointing to those of us who really supported him eagerly. I think the other thing
is because everybody's projecting their own needs into his presidency, and it didn't turn out to be that. Even if he said it wasn't, he never said he was going to have Medicare for all, which I was for. Believe me, a universal health payer. He got what he could, and he got 30-something million people on a roll.
But he's still fighting it, and a big part of it might end up overturned by the Supreme Court.
He's nominated a bunch of weak political hacks to be ambassadors in the bailout, which I think he had to do. He let the Democrats throw in a whole bunch of pork. He was supposed to be above all that, and that's the sort of thing that would have won him great support.
Well, Jimmy Carter thought he was above all that, too. And he wasn't.
And going back to Putin, if you read the report in the New York Times the other day about the three U.S. presidents who have dealt with Putin, Clinton, George Bush II, and Obama, and all three of them, none of the three of them were able to get their arms around this guy. They just misinterpreted.
Figure it out. Yeah. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable program and our panel discussion this morning. It's very good to have you with us. We welcome your comments as always, roundtable at WAMC.org. And we have several comments like these.
Oh, yeah. Like these. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Yes, here they go. Okay. Obama, says Ted. Excellent, Alan. People judge Obama and all presidents by their personal measurements of greatness, and they honestly believe that their criteria is the one everyone should be using. And then, I don't like to use last names. Why is Fox doing so always wrong, even when it presents cogent discussion in film with quotes, e.g. the IRS Stonewall on emails? How is your opinion better when you ignore or reject any thought contrary to your own? A, answer that.
Can I answer that?
Yeah, sure.
But the issue is not them covering what they cover in much the manner that other cable outlets or newspapers or radio stations cover what they cover. It's how much they cover it and where they place it in the letter of importance. I mean, why the IRS is leading
Benghazi
is leading a Fox News report today, after all that's been all the water that's already under the bridge, that suggests an ideological decision with an ulterior motive.
But I love the fact that A is listening to us. Anyway, and you know, not that awful thing. Most of the Kenner says most of the gas goes through Ukraine. Yes, as you say, Putin could change Ukraine, could charge Ukraine a higher price for the time being. But A, it is springtime, and some substituting to other sources could be done before next winter. And B, Ukraine could charge Russia more to transport their gas through Ukraine, and Russia could find other routes to sell their gas and oil to Western Europe or invade Ukraine and deal with heavier sanctions. No free lunch for Putin or the rest of us, says Kenner.
Good letter.
We welcome your letters. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Keep them coming. Let us talk about, continue our conversation about the President of the United States and an article in the Washington Post this morning about the President's chances for filling many of his administration's most important jobs. They say that even with more than 2 years left in his term, the ability to fill those jobs, very important jobs, is rapidly diminishing. White House officials are scrambling to reassess their confirmation strategy in the wake of two major setbacks this month. The Senate rejection of lawyer Debo Adejigbe.
Okay.
Cool, pretty close.
The head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division and signs Surgeon General nominee Vivek Murthy could go down in defeat as well.
And let me point out that there's a very good chance, Joe, that the Republicans, Nate Silver says so, and so it must be, are going to take the Senate. And when that happens, forget about anything.
So what does that mean? And as the president and his team start to reassess the strategy, as they say, what goes into that, and is there a winning proposition here?
Oh, I don't know. But I can say this. I think that there's I like to try to juxtapose what would happen if the Democrats, and when the Democrats, took the Senate in a Republican administration. Would we see the same thing happening? That is happening now? No, you say yes. I say no. I think Tip O'Neill knew better. It was when he dealt with Reagan. So I don't think so. I think they had decided they had been saddled with a president of the United States they didn't want, and they were going to get him no matter what, and that's the way.
And this all started with Bork on the Supreme Court, and that was Democrats who did that.
Well, no, Bork was a bad candidate. I'm telling you that, but it wasn't.
Well, they think that the Attorney General. The Surgeon General is a bad candidate.
Well, no, okay, but it's everything one after another after another after another. Look, we know because Mitch McConnell said so. He gave it away when he said the only thing I can do is try to get rid of this president.
I think the story that Joe alluded to, though, had a statistic that said the roughly in the 70s is the percentage of the appointees that Obama has been able to get through. And that was consistent
about
with his
same
predecessor. Yeah. The difference being the amount of time it takes for Obama's.
I have a view
that's much, much more radical, and it's never going to happen. But I've espoused this for a long time, and let's try it here.
Go for it.
I have been elected to be the president of the United States by the people of this country, and now I am building my administration. Let me appoint whoever the hell I want to appoint. I don't understand, particularly, do we want to set aside the Supreme Court? Okay, I understand that. But if I want to appoint a Surgeon General or a department of this person or that person under my administration to be part of my team, why should I not have the ability to do that?
The Constitution of the
United
States?
That's why I said it's very radical.
Oh, that getting in the way.
I said it's radical.
But because nature abhors a vacuum and because it got really bad, along comes the nuclear option. And the Democrats say...
Right. And yes. I think what you're seeing right now is the Republicans dissing Harry Reid, not Obama. They are annoyed at that, and they should be. And this is why we have the bureaucracy. I'm a big critic of bureaucracy, but this is where it really works. We don't need a Surgeon General. We've gotten along for 2 years without a head of the Civil Rights Division. We don't need another one. We're doing fine.
Rosemary. You need somebody at the top.
You need somebody
responsible. Who are you going to call to the carpet for? I mean, the president...
How about Catherine Sebelius? And when she did do a horrible job, we didn't call her to account.
Well, okay, but the fact is that you got a surgeon, you get a surgeon general, and he stands up and uses the weight of his office and says Coop or one of these other guys and says smoking is bad.
You're going to have a bureaucratic
Surgeon General as opposed to
Alan, you are so wrong.
This guy, as a losing candidate for Surgeon General, has already made the point that guns are a public health issue. That is such an issue. He is much more powerful as a losing, unappointed Surgeon General than if he were in office.
I couldn't disagree with you more. You take a look at how many people have been killed with guns in this country, and it's one of the leading causes of death.
That's what the Surgeon General, the prospective
Surgeon General. I want to make sure I understand. Do you agree that he should have said that or no?
I do agree he should have said it. I think he's absolutely right, and that's why he's not being...
He's
a losing candidate because the Republicans won't approve him because of his stance.
Well, that's exactly
right. The NRA has come out totally against him. He is such a poster child for the messed up way that we appoint people that he's more powerful as a loser.
Oh, I don't think so. I think if he was the Surgeon General and he made that point about guns, it would have tremendous effect. And I don't agree with you, Rosemary, one bit.
And what about Debo Adegbuye?
That's head of the Civil Rights Division of the
I believe I now have it correct.
Attorney General.
Debo Adegbuye.
Okay, so his job is done by Eric Holder. He stands up for it. But you can handle that. It has been handled for two years.
No. Eric Holder himself.
So there shouldn't be a Civil Rights Division?
There should be one. But I'm saying it's not the end of the freaking world that the Republicans won't let him have a head of it.
Well, no, no. You see, I think you're wrong. I think
the guy's already there working.
I think that's where Eric Holder came from, isn't it? Wasn't he the head of the Civil Rights Division?
I think you're right.
I think so.
And this guy still is working there now. He just doesn't have the title. So it's not that big a deal, is what I'm saying.
Well, I go back to my attempt to rewrite
to
Constitution.
Change the Constitution.
I think that this is an area, events and the gridlock in Washington and the and their inability or unwillingness to approve appointees is, you know how we always hear, well, the founding fathers, this is what they had in mind. I don't think the founding fathers had what's going on in Washington now in mind. I wonder whether the Constitution would have been written this way if it was recognized, 250 years ago that political disputes or spite or racism or whatever you want to call it is going to hold up appointees and then perhaps thwart the ability of an administration to do its business. So, I think the Supreme Court, although politics certainly has played into that, that the nature of those appointments and the impact that has on the country
Ira, this is all very nice, but it's not the way it is.
We're here having a little chat about things, and
if I were king or if I were emperor, I'd want this or that. Come on.
All right, let's talk about something else that
I just don't see, Ira, that the business of government.
It ain't going to happen.
It's pie in the sky.
It's not going to happen.
We disagree on that. Noelle just called. She said, "Stop yelling at each other."
Oh, Noelle, we love each other.
Yeah, we do.
It's okay.
Okay. It's all right. You can handle it.
It makes two of us.
Yeah. What else you got?
I was just going to say, I was just looking up Eric Holder. He was Deputy Attorney General of the United States and legal advisor to Barack Obama and also a lawyer prior to that. So not head of the Civil Rights Division.
Oh, Deval Patrick, I believe, was the head of the Civil Rights Division. Maybe I'm wrong about that at one point.
So now you're going to make me do some more.
But in the meantime, while you're doing that,
maybe we could talk about something else. Yes, so let us talk about that. I love this story. I think this is a fascinating story. So we will talk about the NCAA and a union after the short break.
Support for WMC comes from the Odyssey Bookshop, South Hadley, Massachusetts. John Demos will discuss his book, The Heathen School, A Story of Hope and Betrayal in the Age of the Early Republic, Sunday, April 2nd at 7 p.m., odysseybks.com for info. Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, presenting Johnny Clegg, South African singer, songwriter, dancer, anthropologist, and musical activist, featuring Western pop with African Zulu rhythms, April 5th at 8 p.m., troymusichall.org. And New York Pain Management, offering pain management for chronic pain and spine care in a private office setting with Drs. Charles Gordon and Quentin Fung. Be set free, nypainfree.com. Support for WMC comes from Williams College Museum of Art, featuring the paintings and drawings of Berlin-based artist Monica Baer through May 18th, wcma.edu. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years, collegestreetmotors.com. And the Blue Marble, a world of gifts, Amherst, Massachusetts, featuring handcrafted jewelry from around the world, thebluemarble.biz.
Good morning. Welcome back to a roundtable and our very civilized panel discussion that we are having this morning. And we all love one another. And we were just
congressional model, the right honorable Joe Donahue.
Well, we were just doing the group hug during the break, so that's always good. Alan Deval Patrick serves as the United States Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division under Bill Clinton.
So you're
absolutely right. Yeah. Okay. Excuse me. Now, let us go to this, which I think is a fascinating story having to do with college athletics at this time where we are at the Sweet 16 and so forth. A regional director for the National Labor Relations Board ruled Wednesday that a group of Northwestern football players were employees of the university and have the right to form a union and bargain collectively. For decades, the major college sports have functioned on the bedrock principle of the student-athlete with players receiving scholarships to pay for their education in exchange for their hours of practicing and competing for their university. But according to the regional NLRB director, tore down that familiar construct in a 24-page decision. He ruled that Northwestern scholarship football players should be eligible to form a union based on a number of factors, including the time they devote to football, as many as 50 hours some weeks, the control exerted by coaches and their scholarships, which Mr. Orr deemed a contract for compensation.
And I would say, add one other thing to it, Joe, if I may, and that is, and Ira is the sports guy among us, but I would add the fact that, you know, football is a very dangerous game. And a lot of these guys, this is sort of the minor leagues before they go on to the NFL and the rest of it. And so, therefore, their chances of getting hurt are darn good. And so if you're gonna be there and you're gonna potentially risk everything, I think that there's an argument to be made for this, Ira.
I can't even articulate correctly how much disdain that I have for the big time college athletics and what has become of big time college athletics, and in particular as it's managed by the NCAA. The amount of greed and corruption that has occurred as the money stream has increased to a factor of, you can't even, an infinite factor, particularly in the last 50 some odd years, as the TV money has come in.
And billions and billions
and
billions
equipment,
of dollars.
Endorsement money. You have coaches on many campuses in this country who are the highest paid employees, not only and on private campuses, state colleges such as the University of Connecticut, the basketball coaches there are the highest paid people in the state among public employees. And college presidents who are seeing money coming in from sports and are able to help balance not only their immediate budgets but their capital expenditures are in many cases looking the other way.
So is a union an answer?
So the question is the union, and I'm not normally one who would be an advocate of the union, but I just think it's hilarious and good for them, because it's going to it's a message that has to get through to the NCAA that this is coming, and they've got to figure out a way to do something with these athletes, because as Alan points out, a lot of them get hurt. Most of them don't make the NFL and make big money, or the NBA and make big money. And it's imperative, if you're interested in this subject, that you get HBO and you watch this week's HBO Real Sports.
Yeah.
The first segment this week happens to be on this very subject from this point of view. The argument has been athletes don't need to be paid because they get full rides, they get full scholarships, although not all of them. This speaks to the long-held belief that the kinds of courses that the athletes take are, in effect, basket weaving. They are demonstrating in this segment how ill-prepared these students are, many of them, when they leave college with a diploma that's just barely worth the piece of paper that it's printed on, who don't make the pros and the millions of dollars, and who are having difficulty finding any kind of work, much less work that really pays a decent wage. And then one other piece is, you have one athlete who is profiled who, to his credit, is trying to teach himself how to read by reading Dr. Seuss books to himself. He hides them under his bed in his dorm so nobody else will see them. This all is under the umbrella of the NCAA not paying these athletes, not allowing them to get some sort of endorsement deals or outside work. And as been one final point, as has often been pointed out, if I go to college on a music scholarship and I'm a piano player and I have the opportunity to earn $100 on the weekend playing piano at a bar mitzvah, I can
do it.
You can't do that if you're an athlete.
Right. Right.
So I think there's a reason why in this country unions have fallen back to about 8 or 10% of the employees, because laws have been passed, and in many respects you don't need unions anymore. But in an instant like this, this is a case where I'm cheering them on because I'm hoping that it's going to put the pressure on the NCAA to try to do something for these athletes.
It's a great point, because that real sports piece.
Did you see it?
Yeah. With Brian Gumbel and Bernie Goldberg, and they just did a fantastic job in looking at opening. That's a great program anyway.
Yeah, and one other program to watch, it's not currently on, but maybe you can find it. It's a ESPN 30 for 30 documentary called Requiem for the Big East, and it was about the formation and then the demise of the Big East Basketball Conference and all of the money that was involved with that, from to where it got and how the greed made it split apart.
What is it? Was $7 billion for the football contract, $10 billion for the basketball contract?
In Big East, yes. I think so.
Yeah, I mean, that's all. Yeah. We're talking huge, no, huge
unreal,
money.
And the athletes
you mean
are
from
not
the, from the television.
Yeah,
from the television,
well, it's all, you know, it's TV money. It's, you know, look at all of the athlete, the coaches who get money from the Nikes of the world to get their products to be used by their team and the logos to be shown on their uniforms. The coaches are making that money. The players are not.
Let me ask you guys a question. Other than, because it seems to me this is a no-brainer, as you indicate, but other than the college, the colleges themselves and the NCAA,
NCAA.
Is there? It seems to me there's got to be wide approval for this in this country.
No. Of the unionization? Oh, I don't know. I think statistics show elsewhere otherwise. I saw, was it on that HBO program where they said the. I don't want to misquote it. I don't think it's a slam dunk. I think many people believe that the scholarships, if you go to a college that, you know, it could be $250,000 over 4 years, that that's pretty good compensation. And if you're an athlete, you're using it as a minor league to springboard yourself. And if you don't, at least you have a diploma. But we're finding, one, that the diploma in many cases is not worth anything because they're not preparing them. And secondly, many athletes don't make it into the pros, either because they're not good enough or because
they
get
had
injured.
College education
they come out of it with
sports,
nothing.
Right.
And also, I mean, I'm sorry, Rosemary, okay. But I mean, one thing that piece pointed out, and I think it should be pointed out, we had Ed Breslin on the program earlier this week talking about this very thing. There are other, when you look at the Ivy League and other where education is very much more, there are programs that do it.
Yeah,
it
but
is,
you know
it
what?
It's not universal.
When I, yes, absolutely, there are clean programs, but I must tell you, just so you'll know that I'm not being consistent, I am being consistent on this. I was very critical on our editorial page some years ago when the State University of New York elevated Albany, Buffalo, Stony Brook, and Binghamton into the Division I status, which is the big-time college status. And I said, and I wrote at that time, and I didn't write many editorials by that time, that this was opening the door to problems. And within several years, there was a notable scandal at SUNY Binghamton involving, I don't even remember what it involved, but it was a mess, and to the extent that the chancellor appointed the former chief judge, Judith Kay, to do a special commission investigating. These kinds of things are not universal, but they are more likely to happen in this atmosphere of money and greed and all for bring the best athletes that you can find on campus so that you can win games and get donations and get TV money. One of my sons went to the University of Connecticut. I hadn't been on that campus for about 15 years, and we went just to tour it. He said, "You got to see the campus. It's different. You wouldn't recognize the campus between mm-hmm. then." And I can't swear to it, but I can't believe that much of the building on that campus was paid for by the television money that both the men's and women's basketball teams at Connecticut have earned over the years. And for that reason, you have college presidents who are either looking the other way or encouraging this kind of thing.
Well, okay, but I just want to point out, because we have a wonderful state university system here with incredible amounts of building on all of them. I went back to a Hunter College thing, which is now Lehman College. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I just couldn't believe the size of the campus. My point being, Ira, Hunter College is not making big money on its football team, nor is SUNY at Albany. They may get better.
I'm not convinced of the importance to the four SUNY schools that are now Division I schools that they needed to be. There was no other reason.
Even after the passage of time from since your initial.
There's no editorial. Other. What reason is there for the State University of New York, whose mission is supposedly to educate people?
Well, but
this,
Ira, you're answering your own question. Yeah. It's the same reason that everybody else.
Okay, money. And so now, and that's
or
right.
Money
and,
or prestige.
And when you open the door, when you open the floodgates for the kind of money that is going to be coming through the window and the potential for miscreants to get involved or for the kinds of things that we were describing earlier to get involved, you're creating a whole level of difficulties for yourself that could wind
still,
up.
There's such a romance about this student athlete. We see it in the Olympics too, that we call people amateurs who are just so far from amateurs. And on a college level, there's
amateurs don't have $5 million contracts.
Exactly,
with Nike,
they
right?
don't.
Now this union thing has all sorts of implications, and it has all sorts of problems because
and unintended consequences.
Well, there's the legality of it with Title IX. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things, and this NLRB ruling was a localized ruling. I don't know if it will survive the test of time, but the best thing that can happen as a result of this ruling is for this issue to bubble up again, because I'm seeing on some of the broadcasts this morning that when they weren't talking about the plane, they were talking about how restrictive, unfairly so, is the NCAA, and something has to change because these guys and men and women do deserve to be paid.
We are out of time. I want to thank everybody who called in or wrote in and shared with us. You can continue the conversation online, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. Rosemary, Ira, Alan, thank you so much.
Welcome.
Appreciate it.
I talked so much about – I didn't get a chance to talk about the weather.
It was
we
good.
Always have time for the weather. Right? You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.